Welcome to A Cult of Personality at acultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to A Cult of Personality, esoteric podcast extraordinaire. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and you can find our website at occultofpersonality.net, featuring an extensive archive of recorded interviews. A Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and the subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section. This episode is also sponsored by a donation from Steve. Thanks again. This episode is also brought to you by The Lifted Lance. The Lifted Lance is the official journal of Knights Templar Oasis, OTO. The Winter Solstice edition is available, featuring original artwork, poetry, prose, reviews, and an excellent research paper on St. Michael de Molinos by Frater Aka Dua. Obtain your copy of The Lifted Lance for only $5. Email info@knightstemplar-oto.org for details. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. Now, in episode number 139, our guest is Iao 131. Iao 131 is the author of Naturalistic Occultism, An Introduction to Scientific Illuminism, as well as the recently published Thelema Sutras. Iao 131 is also the co-producer of the excellent Speech in the Silence podcast, the creator and editor of the Journal of Thelemic Studies, and author of many other essays on the subjects of Thelema, occultism, psychology, philosophy, mysticism, and magic. You can find his website at iao131.com. That's iao131.com. Iao 131, I would like to welcome you to A Cult of Personality podcast, and thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Love is the law, love under will. I'd like to start by asking how you became interested in Thelema and the path that led you there.
Well, it's not an incredibly interesting story. I suppose, I don't know, some people have the nature of being inquisitive and asking questions. I was always interested in the big questions. Why are we here? Who am I? Who are you? What's the purpose of my existence? What's the nature of the universe? That is my blessing and curse, I suppose. And that led me, I suppose around the age of 12 or 13, I started reading things that one might call philosophy. I was interested in a lot of different things. I encountered the American Transcendentalists of Emerson and Thoreau pretty early on in my education, and they had a pretty big impact on me, and I kind of went from there. So, got into high school, got into drugs, of course, hallucinogens and those kinds of things fell into my lap and my mouth, and the I suppose the natural reaction to that is to try to understand it. You know, what is this? What's going on? Is this real? Is this more real than normal consciousness? And that led me to the trippy philosophers, people like Timothy Leary, Richard Alpert, also known as Ram Dass, the crazier of them, like Terence McKenna. And I was, you know, tripping out, rocking out to Jimi Hendrix and such. And I came across Alan Watts, who is kind of a nice bridge between the psychedelic scene and the Eastern religious scene. I read a few things on Taoism in particular, and I have some weird compulsion to want to read the original. Like, I don't care what other people say about it, at least not before I've read the original. And so got the Tao Te Ching, and I would say that's my first kind of holy book that really captured my attention and colored my way of thinking. And then naturally I spread out my interests to Theravada Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, the Upanishads of Hinduism, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, Vivekananda. And at this point in my life, I was kind of the mind that, you know, Western religion is so corrupt, we should just forget about it. We should destroy it, get rid of all traces of Judeo-Christian Islam. But I started getting an interest into symbolism, you know, seeing it everywhere in the world, because it's everywhere. And somehow came across Morals and Dogma by Albert Pike. And somewhere in there, I believe, I could have made this up, but I'm pretty sure in there it says, to understand our mysteries, you have to understand the Kabbalah. So there's another rabbit hole. And if you study Kabbalah and Freemasonry and symbolism, you will inevitably come across Aleister Crowley. And I found Crowley's book 777. I picked it up. I read it all the way through. I understood absolutely nothing, and I put it back and put it away. Then later, by a chance occurrence, I was at a friend's house, kind of wandering around, looking at his brother's bookcase, and I picked out a book at random, and it was Magic, also known as the Big Blue Brick, because it's a magical weapon in itself if there's ever an intruder in your home. So I started reading that. And it starts out talking about meditation as the development of the human brain. And that really intrigued me. I had read William James' The Varieties of Religious Experience, and I really liked the kind of naturalistic approach to religion and spirituality because, you know, if you're moderately educated, you come to learn about things like physics, chemistry, biology, maybe psychology, and it's natural to want to try to make a comprehensive understanding of the world that includes all these things. So I started to read Crowley, and he was talking about samadhi as a chemical change in the brain or as a state of consciousness just as real as sleep or intoxication, and that is the point at which I was hooked. And then I read everything I could find by Crowley, which was not too hard because the internet existed. And basically, it's something that's hard to describe, but I had read many different Western philosophers, many different Eastern texts, Eastern philosophers. And then when I started reading about Thelema, it was this kind of deep but immediate sense of this is what I was looking for. And since then, I've always considered myself a Thelemite. And I suppose that's a whirlwind tour of how I came to Thelema.
Just as an aside, I'm curious, you didn't get the sense that the Eastern religious institutions were corrupt in the same way as those in the West? Or is that maybe just a byproduct of the culture that we live in?
I think to be completely honest, I think it has to do with the fact that I live in a Western culture and I see its effects. Whereas if I lived in Sri Lanka or something and read the New Testament, I'd probably be like, wow, this Christian philosophy is amazing and humble and loving. That's great. But obviously there's Hindu institutions that encourage classism, and there's Hindu people that committed atrocities in war. There's even Buddhist people that committed atrocities in war. I think it's just very human to use philosophy and religion to subjugate people. Mm-hmm. I was young and impressionable. The fact of the matter is I looked at the original texts, and not so much at how that was translated into reality socially and politically, at least at first.
Right.
So I kind of came in touch with the what I would consider the essence of the philosophy, or the essence of the ideas, which is to say that, I mean, eventually I came to learn that Eastern philosophies lead to similar corruption and injustice and ridiculousness, and vice versa. I think Aleister Crowley helped me understand the depth and beauty of the Western traditions as well. Mm-hmm. So aside from him uniting science and religion, he also united East and West for me. And again, I think that's something a lot of people, a lot of friends I have spoken to similar or the same kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Would you be willing to talk a little bit about your moniker, Yao131?
Sure. First of all, you're one of the few people that pronounces it correctly, so 10 points. So the moniker, the pseudonym, the motto, Yao131, I see it in kind of two different ways, which is its practicality and its meaning. So originally, the name came about because I was posting on internet forums and being a troll and flaming people, and I got banned from Lashtal.com, I think, like 3 or 4 times, and let back in and banned again. And then I just picked a new name, which was Yao, a Gnostic name of God, and 131, which is a significant number to me. So that's kind of how it came about. The practicality of it is that I started writing under this name on forums and started writing some crappy essays, and it's kind of like a brand. Like it gained traction. People started recognizing it, and I ran with it. And I tell some people I don't even really like the name, but it has a life of its own. And why would I fight against the momentum that it has? That's the nature of a brand, I suppose. And I also do some psychological work, some clinical work, and it would not be great, at least at this point in my career, for people, including employers and clients, to look up my civil name and then find all these wackadoodle things I'm writing about. Mm. Some people claim that I am afraid and a coward for hiding behind a pseudonym, and they may be right, but that is certainly not my intention in using it. This is going to sound kind of contradictory. I think it's kind of humble to not put everything to your civil name, to just have this kind of identity floating out there in the ether that can be – people can project their own fantasies as to who this person is onto the name. And what's amazing is people will meet me and they'll treat me as a person that they're meeting rather than the person they've fantasized me to be. Although lately more and more people seem to be connecting my civil and magical identities. Mm. So that's not happening as much.
Yeah, you raised some really interesting points there. Immediately what comes to mind is in ancient or more ancient times, writers would often use a pseudonym or ascribe their work to a more well-known or mythological figure.
Yeah.
Hermes Trismegistus is a very popular one.
50 people named Dionysius.
Exactly. And while some people may want to disparage your use of a pseudonym or magical motto, I think, as you mentioned, it gives you greater freedom of expression and allows you separation from your online identity. And you're right, because people, if they know who you are and your work, and they've meeting you for the first time, they're absolutely going to treat you differently than a regular person that they don't know at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of dread being someone like Lon Duquette, where there's people kind of flocking to him, mostly because I'm introverted and don't want to talk to people, but also having all those people who, you know, it's Lon Duquette, everyone loves his work, and I'm sure he gets tackled by people trying to get his attention and talk to him. Yeah. And I couldn't handle that.
Yeah, I think I can't speak for anybody else, but I think what ends up happening is the persona gets constructed to kind of shield one from all of that. And it's very difficult to penetrate and meet the real person behind it, which is unfortunate, but necessary.
Yeah, and the persona takes over. I mean,
yes,
that's something that people criticize Crowley for, although I'm not sure to what extent that actually occurred, but it happens to celebrities all the time and other people on different scales.
Yeah. While it's nice because, you know, you have people who would treating you better than they normally would if they didn't know, at the same time, there's this absolute fakeness about all of it and this projection of who they, like you said, who they think you are onto you. And then you have to kind of respond with that. And it's very inauthentic.
Yeah. I don't like inauthentic things.
Me neither.
I prefer people to have the space to project whatever they like onto me, whether it's an angel or a demon. And some people kind of, I feel like it allows people to read the material and on the basis of it being material, the fruit of it, the merit or value of it, rather than, oh, this was written by, you know, a 20 millionth degree or a PhD or whatever. People tend to approach it just as the material itself. Although, like I said, as time goes on, that seems to be less and less the case.
Mm. So I'm curious why you started writing and even more so why you wanted to write these books, Naturalistic Occultism, An Introduction to Scientific Illuminism, and the Thelema Sutras.
You know, this is a mystery I'm still uncovering myself. It's funny, I actually did not identify myself as a writer until very, very recently, probably within the last year. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have described myself as a writer to other people. But it was pointed out to me, you write a lot, you're a writer. And kind of went, oh, yeah, that's true. I think the original impetus was I'm a very kind of competitive, semi-narcissistic person, and when I got interested in Thelema, I was online and very much from the internet, and I saw little to nothing written by contemporary Thelemites on Thelema. I saw some people's live journals where they complained about how bad other Thelemites are at being Thelemites and flame wars, and an occasional essay or blog or whatever that described it. It just seemed like a huge void to me. Now I know there's lots of other people writing, not necessarily on the internet, but different journals, local body publications, etc. But my original impetus was I want to create a resource for people to not necessarily learn about Thelema, but think about it, because I don't, by any stretch of the imagination, consider myself an authority in any sense. I'm just a man among men, putting out my view of things, and hopefully other people can learn from it or set up a chain of thoughts that is semi-pseudo-illuminating.
Mm-hmm.
The books, I would say naturalistic occultism came out of a similar kind of drive or impetus, which is that I really, really resonate with the stuff Crowley wrote, in particular, in between about 1909 and 1919, which is the period of the equinox.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when he wrote about scientific illuminism, and he wrote Book of Lies during that period,
mm-hmm.
which is my favorite book by him.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that one.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy and also amazing to me.
Yeah.
But I actually wrote a couple of essays while I was in undergrad studying cognitive science and neuroscience. I read a couple of essays on the neuroscience of the astral body and astral projection, which actually came out of a paper I wrote for school. And that was kind of the kernel that all the rest of the writings developed around. And it's actually still a chapter in the book. But then I said, well, why don't I write about other practices, divination and scrying and all the other stuff that's in the book. And then thought, well, why don't I write about the attitude itself, the approach itself of scientific illuminism? And I basically wrote a bunch of small essays that became chapters in the original book. The second edition expanded on it mostly by taking a step back from the practices themselves and taking a look at what the approach entailed. Just in general, of what does it mean to be a scientific illuminist? What kind of theory of anything? How do we think about things if we're trying to be scientific and also be occultists? Because there's always two sides in what I see as the kind of occult debate. There's the scientists who piss on everything occult and say it's all fantasy and delusion. And there's the occultists who say it's all real and it's all amazing and you just don't know my angelic wisdom, and generally kind of discard science willy-nilly.
Yeah.
And I and many, many others know that that's not the case. It's not just it's a false dichotomy. And scientific illuminism is exactly that. It's the method of science, the aim of religion. So I basically wrote that, and the feedback I got very early on is, you beat me to the punch, that lots of other people were thinking the exact thing. I just happened to be a little manic and write it down first. So I think it represents kind of a part of a current that already exists but hasn't been given much of a voice yet.
Yeah, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I want to mention that I have no idea what other people's reaction to your book, Naturalistic Occultism, is. But to me, this book is in some ways deceptively simple. But when you get into the content, I think it challenges so many preconceptions that people who are into esotericism carry with them, that it's actually a very important book, and not just for people who are interested in Thelema or people who consider themselves Thelemites. I would say this isn't very important book for anyone who's into practicing esotericism or the study of esotericism, even if they don't practice it, because the approach you outline here, you're right. You've eliminated the false dichotomy step by step and through a number of different areas in your descriptions. And I have to say, the thing that really, really struck me about the book was the way that you convincingly took apart the whole concept of psychologization of magic or occultism. Many people, myself included, before I read your book, in fact, had a very negative view of the application of psychology to esotericism. Since I've read your book, I have pretty much completely changed my perspective on that. And I'm just wondering if you can say a few words about psychologization and esotericism and why it is perhaps a good thing.
Well, wow, thank you for that. It's hard to describe, but I am a practitioner. I speak from experience, and so I know that rituals, for example, like if you do the lesser ritual, the pentagram, certain things do happen. You can, whether it's working yourself up into a crazy, delusive stupor, or it invokes magical force from the Yetzeratic world of the Kavlabla, it doesn't really matter. Something happens, and it's important because it's a method among methods that allows you to explore yourself and explore consciousness. And so my raw data, so to speak, is that these things are not just for play. They actually do things. And like I said earlier, in different contexts, it's natural to want to ask, what is this? What's going on? And my first real kind of introduction to the union between psychology and spirituality / occultism / religion was Carl Jung. And again, I'm actually looking at an entire shelf of Carl Jung right now. I read the original works by him in his collected works, including The Archetypes and The Collective Unconscious, Psychology and Alchemy, Alchemical Studies, Aeon, Mysterium Conjunctionis, Psychology and Religion. And he had the exact same problem, which is that people, namely Christians, were accusing him of psychologizing religion. And his response was basically like, you don't understand. I'm not trying to explain this away. I'm actually trying to explain how powerful the human psyche is, how complex and deep and amazing it is for it to even be possible for these things to occur, for archetypal symbols to arise from the unconscious in dreams and different meditations and imagination. And that kind of approach, where there's a kind of reverence and awe for the material, the raw data itself, but also not jumping to some kind of supernatural metaphysical conclusion of trying to fit it into an understanding that is both true to the theoretical side of psychology as well to lived experience of oneself, that really, really deeply influenced me. And that idea in the book seems to be one of the more powerful ones, which is that I write a lot better than I speak, so forgive me if my paraphrase sucks, but it's not reducing the amazing quality of religious experience to mere psychology. It is the other way around, which is to say that it is showing that the psyche, the the soul, the consciousness of human beings is capable of these amazing things, that this is in us, that we are the source of it, and we are capable of experiencing it. And people tend to accuse me of psychologizing things, but for some reason don't accuse Lon Duquette of it. I think it's because he's a lot more clever than I am, but he says it's all in your head, you just don't know how big your head is. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much the same thing that I say.
Yeah. Yeah, that point came through the book like a fucking laser beam. But it was...
Wow, that sounds violent.
It was. It was a little violent for me. Probably because of the preconceptions that I had with me as I came to your book. But since I've read it, you know, I've encountered this idea elsewhere. I mean, obviously, Crowley's writings are, you know, he talks about this in maybe different language, but I encountered it in an even more ancient source, and when I was reading it, I couldn't help but think about your book, and that was Paracelsus and his writings mm-hmm. on the human imagination, and it was like your book was just like echoing back to me as I read his words about the power of imagination and the amazing feats that are capable when humans inflame their imagination. And, you know, to me, it was like just hearkening back to your book completely. So yeah, this idea has been out there for a long time, but I feel like since science and spirituality separated, the discipline of psychology is matured, that esotericists often shy away from any kind of science or scientific explanations for things. And this is, again, something you address in your book, that it is important for people practicing these arts to be scientists. I'm just wondering right. if you could say a couple words about that.
It's interesting to me that Crowley and people that follow Crowley, well, for the most part, seem to just naturally understand this, which is... the tradition of esotericism and occultism and many other disciplines, but specifically those, they have traditionally rested on tradition, which is to say, this is right because Eliphas Levi said it, or however you say his name. This is right because some authority said it. And usually, the older it is, the more authority it has. He said this, and it was 3,000 years ago, so it must be true. And there's a beautiful apocryphal story where a bunch of monks or whatever were debating over how many teeth a horse had, and one said, this authority says it's this amount, this authority says it's this amount, and Francis Bacon said, why don't we open the mouth of a horse and count? And that was the beginning of science, of empiricism, which is making observations, making your own observations of what happens and testing hypotheses. So the difference, for just as one example, let's take the physical position for meditation. The traditionalist approach would say, well, Patanjali says the best position is the full lotus with the left foot upon the right leg and the right leg over the left. What do you do? The scientific tradition would say, why don't you try it out and see if it works for you? If it cuts off your circulation to your entire body, that's probably not the best position for you. Maybe try another one. And which is to say, the foundation of the scientific approach to spirituality, to occultism, to esotericism, is to experiment. It's not to take authority for their word. You might listen to it. You might say, well, this includes Crowley. Well, Crowley said this, and he had experience, so I'll try it out for myself. But that's not where it ends. You say, well, Crowley did it, and it's not working for me. Does that mean I suck? Does that mean I'm sinful? Does that mean I'm just not cut out to attain enlightenment? No. The scientific approach is fundamentally one of success is your proof, as the Book of the Law says. It's written into Thelema, into the central holy book, which is very similar to the older by their fruits ye shall know them, which is very, very, very different from the kind of occultism and esotericism that existed before Crowley. I think he's incredibly unique in this, and this kind of empirical approach to life is so embedded in our modern culture and psyche that we don't realize how incredibly novel the approach of scientific illuminism really is, or just the scientific approach of practitioners to their practice.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think this would be a good segue into asking you about your opinions on Thelema within the wider context of Western esotericism. In your book, you make some comparisons to other modalities, and I think you don't disparage them, certainly, but the comparisons are valid, and I'm just wondering if you could sort of place Thelema in a wider context for us.
Sure, that's kind of difficult. I think Thelema is unique in a lot of ways. So the most fundamental way is that occultists of all types, even anyone who considers themselves spiritual, if they haven't kind of accepted or grown up with whatever traditional religious values have been given to them, they're kind of floating in the ether. And I think we all know that feeling to some extent of what is good, what is true, what should I really be doing, what should be my focus. Mm-hmm. And the fundamental difference is that Thelema says, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. This is 11 words that really can be reduced to one, Thelema, which means will. It can be reduced to a single word that is the guiding principle of everything, of metaphysics, of ethics, of the point of doing occultism in the first place at all. That is what really fundamentally distinguishes Thelema from me. And all the rest of it, all the whole theology and symbolism, all the other holy books and all the rest of the Book of the Law, all the organizations, it's all kind of commentary on that one line. And it's such a beautiful, concise, and elegant thing that there is a single principle that everything is referred to, a single word. That there's nothing remotely like that in any other occult or esoteric writer. In fact, most of them are just Christians who are interested in occultism and esotericism, which is fine. But it seems to lend itself to a kind of aimlessness, like, to what end am I doing any of this? To what end am I learning any of this? And if someone is really honest with themselves, if they're really introspective, looking deep within themselves as to their motives and their drives, I think they'll actually uncover the fact that at the base of it, it really is do what thou wilt. They're trying to find their true will. They're trying to find their truth, the knowledge of themselves. It's just that Thelema has made this conscious and made it put it to the forefront, so to speak. Mm-hmm. That's kind of it, mm-hmm. to me. What I think you're looking for is the fact that I kind of identify Thelema with scientific illuminism, that these traditions are steeped in each other and they really are each other. They both come from Crowley. And certainly Crowley wrote from this perspective, at least especially from that period of 1909 to 1919. And in that book, I kind of say there are these other traditions out there that in the book, I admit these are kind of caricatures, because you can't really characterize an entire current or an entire system in, what is it? I don't know. It's like 5 pages long or something short like that. But there are the traditional hermetic, esoteric magicians, and they put tradition, like I was talking about before, above everything else. They don't really care what your own experiments have found. They care what Alphonse Louis Constant has said, and what, you know, nowadays Israel Regardi or, you know, McGregor Mathers has said this or that. And the similarity is that Crowley came up through that system. And so the kind of uniformity and clarity and the systemization of everything, all the pentagrams and hexagrams and levels and grades and words, etc., that's all great. But the fundamental difference with Thelema is success is your proof, not Eliphas Levy is your proof, or whoever else, even Crowley. Crowley's not your proof. You are your proof. Your success is your proof. And I think the other two that I mention are New Age and Chaos Magic. So New Age, even that term has become like pejorative. I feel like I don't even need to
talk about it.
But I actually find myself the most sympathetic with Chaos Magic, because it takes this kind of, it's not even a different tack. It's a completely different perspective, which is that belief itself is a tool. That belief is not only relative, but can be switched out almost. And that's, to me, that itself is part of the tradition of scientific illuminism. What's different is that Chaos Magic, that's kind of what it's got going for it. Other than that, people tend to want to evoke the spirit of Samuel Jackson or do things that are completely irrelevant or irreverent, which is fine, but it lacks that binding central principle of finding the true will and doing it. It lacks a systematic approach, and it lacks a sense of goal. It's kind of like giving a bunch of guns to people and saying, have at it, rather than saying, we're at war. Here are guns to fight this war. This is the purpose. You're being given these tools. Which isn't bad in my view, but, you know, the kind of craziness and pointlessness of Chaos Magic that I see in Chaos Magicians is not something that I'm particularly interested in for myself, and I don't think it's very characteristic of the Thelemic scientific illuminist approach.
Do you view Thelema through this lens of the aeons, and this is the new aeon and the old is past?
Yes and no. See, this is one of those things where what I just mentioned about Chaos Magic, where belief is a tool, this is really one of those examples where I actually don't think, personally, and this will make me a center of pestilence, I don't think Crowley actually believed there was an eon of Isis that lasted 2,000 years and an eon of Osiris that lasted 2,000 years. I think he was making a symbolic statement that way back in the past, and also way deep in your unconscious, is this kind of maternal, self-nourishing, not even really differentiated kind of self that we identify with the mother. And then after that comes the rise of the ego, of order and power and subjugation of Osiris, and all of the stuff that goes with it, the male formula of dying and being resurrected in a better form, the father giving his seed to the mother so that the seed can grow up as the son, a more perfected version of himself. And now we're in the aeon of the child, of Horus, the union of father and mother, of two in one. I think it's a symbolic kind of statement where we're trying to integrate opposites, because love is the law, love under will, and love being the union of two things. So I think this is reinforced when Crowley says Aeon of Isis is about the past, Osiris is about the present, and Horus is about the future. I mean, that's ridiculous unless you're talking about a set of symbols. He also says the Aeon of Isis is about the material to the exclusion of the spiritual. Osiris is about the spiritual to the exclusion of the material. And the Aeon of Horus is about the spiritual being made one with the material. And that's beautiful. It drives a point home. Anyone who knows anything about history or anthropology knows that this has no basis in actual reality. The age of Osiris probably started, 30,000 years before he claimed it started. There were paternal societies way back then. The way that it's useful to think about is in that symbolic sense of the mother, the father, and then the child that combines mother and father, as well as I think Crowley was really, really harping on Christianity and the kind of decadence or degradation of Christianity, and the formula of self-sacrifice, the formula of morbidity and sorrow and sin. Everything is horrible and we have to subjugate ourselves because we're such sinful beings and we're fallen. That's another sense that we're kind of past the old aeon and into the new. I take it more as we have a paradigm shift. We're going to think of things in a very, very different way. I have no belief whatsoever that it actually can be superimposed over actual human history.
Yeah, I think your explanation is a lot more elegant and makes a lot more sense. Is it useful, and I think you may have implied this already, but is it useful to look at Thelema as the natural successor to Christianity, say, in the same way that I think it would be fair to characterize the Christian point of view as the successor to Judaism, and in the same way that Islam views itself as the successor to both of those?
Right. I believe that is one way that Crowley very intentionally framed Thelema, which is that the Book of the Law and the Law of Thelema and the New Aeon represents a new covenant between God and man. And that covenant has the law, do what thou wilt. That's because of this Western tradition of the covenant of God with Moses, with the law of the Torah, and then the covenant represented by Jesus Christ with his law, I suppose, of love your neighbor as yourself and love the Lord your God. And then Muhammad said that there was a new covenant of him with Allah, with God, that there is no God but Allah, but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Of course, Muhammad said that he's like the seal of the prophets. He's the end, the final word.
Right.
Crowley kind of slapped that away and disregarded it and said, no, we're continuing. And what's really beautiful, one beautiful thing about Thelema is that written into its central holy book is that it actually will end, that it won't be true, so to speak, anymore, that another prophet shall arise, another God will arise, another formula will come after it, that it isn't the final truth. I'm not aware of any other religion that says that we're kind of a stepping stone and things will change. But I think you're right to think in that way, that it's a step from Judaism to Christianity, from Christianity to Islam, and then Islam to Thelema. Crowley actually said that Islam is very much similar to Thelema, but our modern kind of awareness of Islam makes that very hard to understand.
doesn't it, though?
It really does. There's some really great essays by Dionysius Tao Polyphilus about Islam and Thelema and how they're similar. And what's important is that Crowley actually, God forbid, he knew Muslims. He hung out in North Africa a lot. And he saw these people in action, and he saw the similarities. And so this is kind of a side where, for example, Islam, in theory, they believe people of the book, so to speak, are all worthy to be accepted. And that kind of view of, you know, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Thelema, I think that is useful, understanding it from a Western perspective, a Western sense of progression, and a sense that we're all trying to get to the same truth, we're all trying to do the same thing, but we're evolving and moving forward. Nonetheless, I think that it is even more useful to understand there are other perspectives and other maps and modes to understand Thelema. Like, I believe, for example, that Thelema is in another way a direct response to a certain type of understanding of Buddhism. Like, for example, the line "existence is pure joy" is almost certainly a response to Crowley's understanding of the first noble truth of Buddhism, which is often translated or mistranslated as existence is essentially pure suffering. So I think it is useful, but it's most useful if you understand it as a map and as a way to understand Thelema. And I'm a proponent of having as many perspectives as possible, in the way that to appreciate a statue, for example, you're going to want to stand at as many perspectives as possible to appreciate it in as many ways as possible.
This is a great segue also to talk about your most recent book, Thelema Sutras, which, again, I have to say, just blew me away, because the way that you write and describe the philosophies and ideas of Thelema in this context is simply amazing to me.
Oh, come on, you're making me blush.
Yeah, you know, this is really the reason I wanted to talk with you after I read this book. From your writing and the way you speak and express yourself, I expected somebody in their 40s or 50s, but it sounds like you're far younger than that.
This is true.
Which is really encouraging. You're one of the most prolific voices in the Thelema community. Wonderful, really.
Well, thank you. Yes, I am certainly not in my 50s.
Could you tell us a little bit about your book, Thelema Sutras? For people who haven't read it, it's brilliant, and I don't think I can do it justice in a couple sentences.
In the end, it's ineffable, and I can't really describe it, of course. But Thelema Sutras, to me, really represents the fact that, remember, I was talking about how Eastern traditions were something that captured my attention much, much more, at least before the Western traditions. And I was very much steeped in the traditions of Taoism and Buddhism and Hinduism for a few years, and trying the practices and everything before I really tried to integrate the Western perspectives. And so a lot of my thinking has that as a backdrop, which I think is incredibly helpful, because this is just by chance that Crowley was a rationalist Buddhist before he was a Thelema. That's what he was when he received the Book of the Law. And he speaks a lot of times as if you already know everything about Buddhism and about Hinduism. Like, of course you know the three characteristics and the four noble truths and the eightfold path, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of people have some kind of faint idea as to what he's talking about, but not really, especially when he was writing, not really. And Thelema Sutras represents approaching This actually relates to what we were just talking about, the different perspectives of approaching thelema. The Thelema Sutras is approaching thelema on the eastern slope, so to speak, which is kind of with an eastern attitude, an eastern mentality. And I don't mean to be another Westerner appropriating other people's cultures, but it is literally the way I think. And back in 2007, 2008 or so, I tried to translate certain Upanishads into Thelemic language, because the way my mind works is I read the Upanishads and I hear the Thelemic concepts, because fundamentally I'm a Thelemite. And you talk about the boundless, infinite space of Godhead, of Brahman, and I hear Nuit, you know? Mm-hmm. And I typed out a bunch of these Upanishads, these kind of translations, quote unquote, and I kind of left them. Then what happened was, I'm not sure you know about NaNoWriMo. It's the National Novel Writing Month. It's right. November of every year. Mm-hmm. I had tried it before. You're supposed to get a certain amount of words, like 50,000, the point being to kind of get over the writer's block or the self-criticism. And I, for whatever reason, I started writing what's in the middle of that book, The Lost Sutra of Harold. So Harold represents the combination of a bunch of influences on me, which is Eastern mentality, a kind of Nietzschean attitude and disregard for convention, as well as the kind of Discordian irreverence. So I wrote a bunch of material for Harold, and I showed it to some people. I was kind of embarrassed by it because it was very, very different from the stuff I had written before. And people seemed to really like it. And I thought to myself, well, there's actually some stuff that are similar in the Eastern approach, like those old Upanishads. So I went back and I read back over them and I said, these aren't half bad. I kind of edited them, rewrote them, wrote some new ones. There's some in there that are actually not based on Upanishads, but they're just the Eastern style. And I also, at a very similar time, got very into studying the Heart Sutra of Buddhism, with its famous line that form is emptiness and emptiness is form, and vice versa. And I thought to myself, I'm going to write a Thelemic translation of the Heart Sutra, which is a ridiculous thing to do, by the way. And I think it's ridiculous, but the point is to give that perspective of the Heart Sutra while showing that this idea is actually already in Thelema. It's inherent in Thelema. Crowley already talked about this. Mm-hmm. But the Heart Sutra is kind of a lens with which to look at this. So then I cobbled together the Upanishads, the Heart Sutra, Harold, a semi-translation of the Diamond Sutra, which is really just something in the style of the Diamond Sutra. Just smushed it all together. Got an amazing brother named Mustafa to do the cover, and said, well, it's 200 pages or so. Why not make it into a book and put it out there? So I did. By the way, the endless endnotes are actually satirical for the most part of myself, because I'm a Virgo and I love footnotes and endnotes and bulleted lists and numbered lists. It's mostly satirical, but it is full of actual information.
And highly entertaining, I might add. And you said, you know, writing a Thelemic version of the Heart Sutra is ridiculous. And my response would be, yes, ridiculously awesome. Because that's really the way that I perceived it. I'm just curious what other reactions you've gotten to the book have been.
You know, I've actually gotten mostly positive reactions, which is slightly different than naturalistic occultism. I'm not sure initially because the Heart Sutra was one of the very last things that I wrote for it, and my mind was just completely blown trying to write that. And I would be in the middle of it and trying to explain something, and I would just be babbling and have no idea what I was talking about, but I did, and I didn't, and I just didn't know who or what or where I was for a while. But after that, I came back, and I'm normal again, sort of, and the response has generally been positive. I think it helps what I wrote in the preface, which is specifically that I'm not trying to represent the Buddhist or Hindu traditions at all. And strangely enough, that attitude comes from Crowley himself, where he did a quote-unquote translation of Tao Te Ching. Mm-hmm. And he said, many sinologists will take issue with what I've said, but they can stick their yang up their yin. Mm-hmm. I'm saying what I'm saying. And I took that same kind of approach of, you know what, just put away all your knowledge of Buddhism and Hinduism and even Thelema and Kabbalah. Just try to appreciate it as a work of writing, of art. And I think that was good to kind of prime people to not be so critical. There are a few people who said, you know, that's not exactly what, you know, Vajrayana Buddhism of this or that school says, but I did read your preface and I get it. And it's like, oh, thank God, I don't have to explain myself.
No, I mean, everyone I've talked to who's read it has had a very positive reaction. You know, I'd be curious, but not surprised, you know, if people had another reaction to it as well, because I think it does kind of challenge those people who consider themselves traditionalists, even Thelemic traditionalists, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I think it's very challenging because if you notice, there's almost no mention of ceremonial magic in it.
Mm, that was one of the things I liked, actually.
Yeah, I'm of 200 minds about ceremonial magic, and my most fundamental belief is do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, which means that you should do what you will, and that does not mean that everyone should be doing ceremonial ritual. There are other ways to look at things. And Thelema Sutras, if I would just boil it down, it's another way to look at Thelema. It's another approach to the law. And I hope people can appreciate it in that sense, that it's not truth, it's not a challenge to ceremonial ritual even. It's just another way to look at it, another approach, another way of thinking and practicing. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. I want to ask you about Speech in the Silence.
Absolutely.
I don't know exactly what your involvement is with the podcast, but I believe you have some involvement. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about it.
I believe you had Joseph Thebes on your program before.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So Joseph and I created Speech in the Silence together. So we are the co-creators of Speech in the Silence. Mm-hmm. Speech in the Silence was created somewhat in response to other podcasts, specifically Thelema Coast to Coast and Thelema Now, but mostly I believe we were talking and essentially saying there's so much material out there, there's so much knowledge. There's all these Thelemites out there lecturing, making music. You know, there's Thelemic culture, and there's nothing that's capturing Thelemic contemporary culture today. Mm. And so we brainstormed and said, why don't we just, you know, collect all of that material in one place and make it available to everyone for free, you know? Mm-hmm. And originally I was the person that tediously, very, very tediously edited all these segments together and made it coherent. Eventually I got lazy and passed that off to Joseph. The idea was to take modern Thelemites and make their voice heard. And I think that's successful. I think the biggest proof of that is the recent book by Dr. David Shoemaker called Living Thelema, which started as a segment on Speech in the Silence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's amazing and that's great. I'm not going to take credit for it, but I think it kind of gave the medium a venue for him to put his existing wisdom into a form so that other people could appreciate it, and for him to basically organize his thoughts on different subjects, which if people haven't gotten it, the book Living Thelema is amazing. It's really great.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for my copy right now.
It's worth the wait.
Well, I think it's a phenomenal podcast. Obviously, I'm a big fan of it. And I think you guys do a fantastic job. It's wildly successful. And,
it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I mean, if people haven't heard Speech in the Silence podcast, you know, you've got to check it out because it's one of the best podcasts around, in my opinion.
Just of all time, really.
There you go. Before we finish up this section, I just wondered if you could remind people where they can find you and your work online.
The ninth level of torment, you'll find me. I guess facebook.com/IAO131 and IAO131.com, IAO131. I say IAO because if I say IAO131, someone will inevitably type in EAO and then be confused and troubled and then saddened. Possibly depressed. I don't know. But IAO131.com. That's basically the website that collates all the essays I have and kind of links to everything else, I suppose.
Well, I want to thank you very much for this opportunity to talk with you about your books and your work. In the Occult of Personality membership section, IAO131 and I continue our conversation, including his psychological analysis of Liber Al Vel Legis, the Book of the Law. Join us for that portion of the interview, and please remember that Occult of Personality podcast is made possible by subscriptions to the membership section. Just go to occultofpersonality.net/membership. And click the Join Now button. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.